This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. Well, hey, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G, along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing today?
Good. How about yourself?
Not too bad. You know, it's been interesting week in terms of weather at Southern California, but because the summer is coming and life is beautiful, and looking forward to the summer. That's for sure.
And we managed to get the podcast going. So how bad is that?
Yeah. Yeah, it's not as bad. Yeah, the my little garage operation here is slowly but surely turning into something fun.
People have no idea just how primitive we are. All right.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
All right. Well, today, you know, I titled the podcast today, Finding Your Edge in Life. One of the reasons was because I didn't send you the questions in time, so I figured I'd pick something, you know.
Yeah.
But the other reason is that we talk about beating your genes, and really, there isn't anything we can do about our genetics per se, but we are trying to find our edge in life, and we are trying to find happiness and how to optimize our life experience. So, I thought that that's a really key point. Now, before we get started with the questions this week. One of our listeners who had sent us an email maybe 3 weeks ago in one of the shows, I think episode 62 or 61, he has Korean parents, and he was asking how to deal with some of his lack of motivation not really feeling like he's very competitive, as competitive as his parents want him to be. And so what he did was he sent us an email after you answered this question, Dr. Lyle. So here is the email. Dear Dr. Lyle, I've been meaning to write this follow-up email sooner, but I just wanted to start off by saying that anyone who might have doubts about the validity of evolutionary biology or your deductive reasoning, Dr. Lyle, of understanding and analyzing human behavior and personality should know that with just one in-depth question about one aspect of my daily struggle as an adult, you completely and accurately describe things like my upbringing, what my parents were like, and what really impressed me was how accurately you described what type of person I really was during my late teens through my mid-20s. Your assessment of why I behaved in this way was dead on. And it helped me start to look at myself again from a new light and helped me to further understand myself and look into the different aspects of my character and why they are there. And I just wanted to say, I can't thank you enough. So,
well, that is very, very cool.
Yeah, he goes on. That's exactly, you know, and this is great. He goes on to say that he's happy to say that I finally have a stronger understanding of what's motivating me between the different warring aspects of my character in regard to working hard for resources or hardly working. Thanks again for everything and look forward to hearing from you soon. So, Dan, we really appreciate you sending us this email and keeping us updated. This is wonderful. This is why we do this. So, and Dr. Lyle, thank you.
You bet. No, this is great. That's what makes it good. All right. What do we have?
All right. Well, we've got a couple of questions here. We're going to try to get to as many as possible. And so we will start with one of our – we had a lot of questions from last episode. Last episode, as you remember, Dr. Lyle, we had the caller who had a question about his micromanaging boss.
Mm,
and so We've had a lot of emails for that episode. A lot of people asking great, great questions, and we've got some questions left over from previous shows as well. So we'll get started right away and see how many we can get to.
Got it.
So, dear Dr. Okay. Lyle, are there any techniques that you can suggest that a person use to quickly determine where another person falls in terms of each of the big five personality characteristics? Specifically, upon meeting someone, such as maybe a first date or a job interview, are there any specific questions that you can ask or behavior signs or displays that you should look out for to determine, for example, if they're disagreeable, narcissistic, flaky, or maybe trying to conceal those traits, like, say, a psychopath?
Okay. All right. I would say, just in general, probably if you – just as you get to be thinking about the big five plus one, i.e. intelligence, and you just sort of mentally practice putting people that you run into on, one or the other side of the bell curve, and you just sort of do that consistently for a while, you'll just be thinking about human beings in terms of in the same way that you already look at their physical presentation in this way. So you look at their height, weight, fitness level, physical attractiveness. You unconsciously are running bell curves on all these characteristics of the people all the time. And it barely comes to your attention, but you're so expert at it, you don't even think about it. You are also running personality variances, except that you've been doing it without a framework of the big five. Once you have that framework in your mind, then as you're talking to people about anything, you can notice things right away. So, for example, if someone, if you're having a conversation and someone contradicts you about anything, you already know that they are not a highly agreeable person. Just any contradiction at all starts telling you that is a person at least in the middle of the bell curve for disagreeable. And if they contradict you a couple of times in relatively short order, then you know they're disagreeable. You just don't know how far. Looking for that's a characteristic that you just aren't – you're essentially never going to see in highly agreeable people. That's just not something that they do. Let me think about other things. Also, disagreeable people will also complain about other people. So that's a big time red flag about disagreeable. Now, certainly, we all complain about somebody to somebody, but when the nature of the complaints don't match very well the nature of your relationship with that individual, essentially what they are doing is they are leaking their frustration to any old person in the village and trying to win you onto their side to in order to gain political leverage against that evil person who is stealing their time, energy, boyfriend, or whatever the heck it is that they're doing. Then what you're seeing is disagreeable, and you are that's another thing that's happening. People will leak their conscientiousness in cursory conversation. We can tell about a great deal about people just by finding out how long. Like, I can instantly assess people. Let me give an example here. I did thousands of court-ordered evaluations when I worked in Dallas about 20 years ago for the probation department. And so people would come in, and there'd be probationers, and I would be doing these evaluations for the court. And in a matter of a few minutes, I had a few questions that I would ask that I could tell a tremendous amount about people in almost no time. So I'd ask them, where do they live? And so if they hemmed and hawed, or whatever it is that they said might be interesting, they live with their mother, they live in an apartment, they're hanging out with their sister right now, whatever. That's telling you a great deal. And then if whatever their place is that they live, we simply ask, well, how long have you been there? Well, if they say 16 years, that just told you a tremendous amount about their conscientiousness. If they say 2 months, then that tells you something else. If you ask, where do you work? What do you do? How do you make a living? They tell you their story, and then you say, well, how long have you been working there? If you hear 16 years, then you know that they're very stable. If you hear, oh, about a year, you say, oh, really? Where were you before that? Oh, I was with such and such. Well, how long were you with them? Oh, a couple months. Okay, so suddenly this is already telling you a great deal about how unstable their life is. That doesn't mean they are emotionally unstable. It's telling you, it's signaling a high likelihood of low conscientiousness. Now, obviously, there's going to be circumstantial issues that are going to be involved here. But in just a few cursory questions, we can tell a lot about their agreeable or disagreeability. We can actually even see how friendly and pleasant their facial expressions are. People that are disagreeable will very often not have any sort of not very much empathic warmth that will go on with their facial expressions. Sometimes they will, but usually they very likely won't. They're going to have a relatively stern, slightly irritated demeanor, just because that's where they're at. People that are open to experience will usually they may signal it, or there's very little question that you need to get to before we're going to start to hearing about the openness. What do they like to do? You know, where have they gone? What are some things that are really cool? What music do they like? These are sort of dating style questions. But you could ask, it will come up in conversation about their range of things that they like to do and how wild or crazy. And that's going to be telling us a lot about their openness to experience. Actually, how people dress will tell you quite a bit about how open to experience that they are. So these are all ways people are leaking these cues all over the place. They're not just leaking them, they're actually advertising them. So that's why once you start to realize that when someone drives a Volvo, that is a very different signal than a Pontiac Firebird. And when someone is in, you know, blue gabardine slacks with black shoes and a button-down white shirt, that's a very different signal than somebody that's in cowboy boots with jeans that are ripped at the knees and, you know, a black Sabbath jacket. So, and the way people wear their hair is highly significant with respect to their personality. So they are signaling their conscientiousness and openness in their introversion and extroversion in all these domains. So all you have to do is look. And start running your own contingency pattern. A lot of it you already know, you just haven't been listening to it.
Fantastic. Well, we'll have to some student out there hopefully will put together a nice little study on this. I'm sure it's already been done with all this hair patterns and clothes. Jeffrey Miller has a book called Spent where he talks a little bit about
it. Yes. Yeah, so Spent is a great book to educate you in how deeply people are using consumer behavior to signal the big five. So actually, and intelligence. He calls it the central six. So that Spent is highly recommended for anybody that wants to just dig a little deeper into this.
Fantastic. Okay. Our next email is we're going to turn the ship a little bit and talk about long-distance relationships. And so the question is, what are the factors at play for a long-distance relationship? For example, I have a friend in her mid-20s in an on-again, off-again long-distance relationship with her high school sweetheart. Is she just delaying the inevitable breakup?
I don't know. In other words, what we have to do is we have to think about from that 10,000 foot view, every behavior that you see is a derivative of a cost benefit analysis. And so it is possible one of the benefits to not breaking up with somebody is that they're going to be all upset and we've got too much empathy and then their feelings are hurt and then they and that actually can be disturbing for us because people with hurt feelings that could be unstable could potentially do us damage. Their anger could lead them to say bad things about us to the village and therefore damage our reputation. Very often, lovers and ex-lovers are carrying around a little dossier on who we are and all the naughty things we've done and so forth, and therefore we can feel potentially vulnerable. So this is those would be some expenses that she could be delaying on. It's also true that she could be ambivalent about the relationship in general, and that the relationship may be have legitimate positives, and therefore, you know, she's not sure what it is that is actually in her best interest, et cetera. So she could be, this could be also a time when it's a convenient situation for her to not be under scrutiny, where it is that she can stick her toe in other relationships and flirt and calibrate and see whether or not she could trade up. So long distance relationships are inherently very difficult because of the expenses that they impose on relationships in general, not just monetary expense, time and energy expense, the ability to monitor partner behavior expense, the fact that there can't be any real screwing taking place, you know, when there's 500 miles apart. And so all of these things are calculated as expenses. So in order for a long-term relationship to survive, the benefits have to be more striking than they normally would be to keep a relationship alive. So anyway, a lot to consider in there, and every relationship is going to be a little bit different because the cost-benefit analysis that each individual is running on this thing is going to be very dynamic according to the context that they find themselves in terms of their alternative opportunities and their feelings of vulnerability relative to the cost of the breakup, et cetera. A lot of women, a few women will stay in relationships indefinitely because they're in with a whack job that they think is going to beat them up or kill them. Now, obviously, that's not this one that this guy's talking about, but that's an example of a relationship, quote, having legs and surviving for very long periods of time when the only benefit is just so that we don't wind up destroyed. So that's showing you there's an enormous variance of how the cost benefit on relationships are going to be computed. And so everybody's situation is slightly different. If you ask them and nose around and cross-examine them about, you know, where the relationship's at, how they're feeling about it, et cetera, they will start leaking their ambivalences about the situation, and then you can find out why they are going back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Well, that leads perfectly into our next question.
All right.
Our next email. The next email has to do, it's called the sneaky male theory or sneaky fucker theory.
Oh, great.
So, yeah.
You said it. Okay.
Is there any merit to the idea that homosexuality evolved out of the sneaky male theory? In other words, did certain males act in a non-suspicious way, such as being very submissive and non-threatening toward the female mates of alpha males in order to eventually copulate with them? A modern example would be your girlfriend or wife having a gay best friend, and you're not worried about him sleeping with her because he's gay.
Yeah, this was, I believe the person who originated this was Eduardo Wilson, writing in the mid-70s. And it was a legitimate hypothesis. It was an interesting idea, and he got a lot of bad press behind that, which he shouldn't have gotten. It was a totally legitimate hypothesis. I don't think there's any merit to that hypothesis at all, and I've described in another podcast that I believe that the roots of homosexuality have probably been discovered. I'm pretty convinced of it, actually, and that is that it looks like homosexuality, if we think about what is likely driving homosexuality and what the evidence looks like, it looks like it's essentially a heavy dose of estrogen in utero. And so more highly estrogenized women are going to have more highly estrogenized children, and more highly estrogenized children are pretty. And so if your mother or in this case, I mean, it could be carried by the male as well. So the same thing. We're going to simplify this in people's mind's eye so that they can see the lineage effects, but it could have come from the father as well. So think about a woman who is very beautiful, therefore very estrogenized, and then gives birth to, therefore, highly estrogenized children. Now, you could have a father who's very beautiful, and he is highly estrogenized, has estrogenized genes, and he could be giving birth to highly estrogenized children too. But let's just, for the standpoint of mental simplicity, think about a woman who is highly estrogenized, giving birth to highly estrogenized children, and we're going to say there's going to be two boys and two girls. Well, those boys are going to be, quote, prettier than average boys because they're more estrogenized. And the girls are going to be prettier than average girls because they're more estrogenized. And if we get enough estrogen in the system, then one or the two of those boys, their brain may be sufficiently estrogenized that it starts tipping over the mating search image mechanisms that are essentially sex hormone sensitive. And so now we wind up with a gay male. And so it looks like the genes that are responsible for homosexuality, at least in males being on the planet, are probably the exact same genes that are associated with having women be very pretty. And so the way that homosexual genes, i.e. the gene for homosexuality, there isn't a gene for homosexuality, it looks like it's likely to be a side effect of the fact that highly estrogenized genes create very beautiful girls. And in doing so, they also sometimes will cause a gay male to become from those parents. Now, the evidence for this is that that if you actually look at the sisters of homosexual men, the sisters of homosexual men are significantly prettier than the sisters of heterosexual men. So that evidence has been collected and has been reported in the literature. So that overwhelming...
No offense to my sisters.
Nor mine. The point is that my sister got more testosterone than I have. to everybody's disappointment in the but anyway, the bottom line is that this evidence has been collected and therefore this hypothesis is currently supported. That doesn't mean it's the last word on the subject, but I can tell you that it is an extremely suspicious finding that is to me is also elegant, simple, and it is about as close to politically correct as I think we're ever going to get. So at the moment in science, I think we have a good, at least somewhat tentative, but firm-looking theory about how this comes about.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do science say about bisexual men?
Well, this is going to be, sexuality in general is going to be, you're going to have situations where this is essentially messing with the circuitry that would naturally be in the system that would cause essentially sexually dimorphic mating patterns of male and female. And so if you start to, as you start to tip around these sex hormones, you're going to start to find funny little things happening, and you're starting to get a patchwork quilt of mating tendencies. So if you actually look at a gay male, standard gay male, a gay male is not the same thing as a female brain sitting inside of a male body. It is a hybrid. So what you see is it is very typical. I'm not going to say super typical, and I'm not going to say complete. I'm just going to say it's common for gay males to be extremely promiscuous in their in their sort of behavior and their behavior tendencies, in a way that you just almost never see in females. This mimics what goes on inside of heterosexual males if they were in a landscape where they're around a bunch of females who were interested in casual mating, which there is no such landscape, okay? So imagine yourself if you were a normal heterosexual male, Nate, and you were living in a land where as you're walking around, there's all kinds of females around of total varying degrees of attractiveness, and the highly attractive females are absolutely interested in casual mating strategy. And so now the question is, what do you do about this? Well, they've all got pair bond strategy in them, but they also have raging casual mating strategy. And there's no constraint in the social situation because everybody's willing to play casual mating strategy. Well, in that case, you've got a gay pickup bar, okay? So what you don't see is a dominant pair bond strategy inside that culture. So if you think about this, a gay male basically has a female version of a mating search image. So when it says, who should you be looking for? You should be looking for a member of your species that is very attractive, very symmetrical, has excellent secondary sexual characteristics, is i.e. a good specimen with low mutation load. All great. Okay, now, which sex should you be looking for? Well, we got enough estrogen, so we're going to now be looking for a male because that part of our brain sort of thinks that we're a female. And so there you have it. So now we have the mating search image is the mating search image of a female, and it has some other search image characteristics that start looking a little bit more like male search image characteristics in that, for example, they're particularly focused on youth and attractiveness and skin conditions, etc. So you're going to look at the pickiness of the male, the standard heterosexual male who's very interested in attractiveness and fertility cues, essentially. And you're going to put that also in the gay male's brain, but you are But what you don't put in there is you don't put in the female interest or strong dominance for pair bond strategy. So that's what you have. So the gay male looks like a hybrid. A bisexual male is another variation of a hybrid that's less common than straight homosexual. So you had to somehow get the estrogen levels right down some line there, where we wind up literally on both sides of the fence at the same time. You could see how, in principle, that this could happen very easily. And so that's what it looks like out there in the world of human sexuality. It looks like these are just variations when certain genes wind up being certain, gene combinations wind up with either very high estrogen or very high testosterone loads. I think that that's going to be largely responsible and maybe completely responsible for the variation in human sexual psychology that we see.
Mm-hmm. All right, very good. And our next question is actually about the variation in conscientiousness. So as we heard last week on the show, when you spoke with our caller about dealing with his extremely conscientious boss who wants him to copy him on every single email to the whole company. We got a question after that it must have been the boss himself, but the question was, have you guys ever discussed how someone who is relatively high on the conscientiousness scale can deal with folks who are a lot lower on the conscientiousness scale without wanting to kill them?
Well, I think that the important thing is that you have to arrange your life in ways that you're not dependent on people that are low on the conscientiousness scale, and a big part of your job in life is to see to it that very few of the factors of your existence have anything to do with the low conscientious people. And so so our caller, if they are stumped, our person here is stumped about how it is to solve such a problem with a low conscientious person that they're dragging along like an albatross around their neck through this life, then they need to write a more specific question, and we will answer it about how they're going to get out of that relationship.
Fantastic. Yeah. He followed up and said he's got flaky customers and then neighbors who he had split season tickets with for the Braves. But maybe this is good for an on-air session sometime in the future.
The flaky, who is it? Flaky relatives? What was it? For flaky
neighbors.
Customers?
Customers and neighbors. Oh, and neighbors.
The customers are simply responding to cost-benefit contingencies and incentives. And so it just means that the value proposition that he's in competition of offering, he is not able, because of market forces, in order to pin people down, because he's got competitors that are essentially trying to lure these same flaky people into relationships, and therefore he's got a competition problem. The somebody that has their market cornered or has their market set doesn't have to deal with flaky anything. They simply say, hey, no problem. This is the situation. This is the expectations. And if you don't meet those expectations, no problem. You can go down the street. Bye. Okay. And that's the end of the flakes. But if we are not in that situation, then we have a marketing problem, because we are under market pressure to broaden out our marketing efforts to include too many people, including flakes. By the way, this is actually an important principle for businesses in general, and flakes are expensive. Okay, flakes are responsible for a high percentage of theft, returns, non-payment, collections, et cetera, et cetera. So this question is not as sort of benign and just fun as we think. It's actually a very significant problem, and it should be in anybody's sort of personal floating business model of life that I'm not kidding. Part of beating the genes is don't get greedy and try to get too much of the market with respect to anything. And you should be looking at conscientiousness as a major potential expense in any relationship with anybody, including Nate's flaky ability to get this thing off the ground. I just couldn't resist. It just occurred to me, Nate. I just wanted to pull your chair.
Oh, God.
No, you're so totally exonerated, but it just
so everybody knows.
Popped down.
I texted Dr. Lyle before the show started and said, for some reason, my with a lot of expletives in there, my computer is not working and my internet decides to screw up every time. And if I could afford it, I probably would have destroyed everything in my vicinity because of how stressful it was.
Very good. So you show your conscientiousness by your great distress for our program. All right, let's move on.
You got it. I guess so. Yeah. All right. Our next question is actually having to do with parenting. Dear Dr. Lyle, I have a 19-year-old son who I believe is addicted to gaming, and it's wreaking havoc in his personal life with pornography and in his working life. Plus, although I kept rather strict practices around computer use when he was younger and used parental control software, I believe that his difficulties at school are also due to computer use. Of course, now that he's legally an adult and has been earning his own money and buying his own technology and paying me board, I feel I don't have the same level of control as his gaming has taken over. More recently, he lost his job because he just wasn't showing up. And although he says it was due to poor health, especially migraines, this is only partially true. The majority of the genuine sick days are caused by his lack of sleep and screen exposure contributing to his migraines. He seems to have no interest in finding another job or even applying for the unemployment benefit. After listening to your episode on dealing with flaky and lazy children and using gloat therapy, I've given him 6 weeks' notice to move out and fully intend to follow through on this, regardless of whether he's found a job or somewhere to live by this time. However, I'd be interested in Dr. Lyle's thoughts about screen addictions in general and what parents can do to help their children and how I can help my young man in general. I'm trying to find a screening of screen angels I can go my son seems angry and depressed, and he has very few friends and social interactions offline and refuses to talk to me. I feel so worried for his future and am completely lost as to what to do. I'm just so ill-equipped to deal with this kind of problem. Looking forward to hearing your thoughts.
Yeah. I'm concerned about a few things. I don't know all of what's going on with the young man. So there are details here, and I don't want to be like Dr. Laura and just tell you exactly what to do when we have to understand that there are, you know, personality and circumstantial nuances that it's not necessarily clear to me what I would do. I do think that I would be kindly making sure that I knew where he was going to go in 6 weeks. In other words, that he would have some we would have some plan. Like, you know, of course he may not come up with a plan until a week to go. I would follow through, and I would what we're wanting to do is we're wanting to put the fear of God in him. That right now he doesn't believe it, and he who knows what the situation is there, whether this is a single parent or there's a if this is a man and he's got a wife, and what the wife is going to have to say about kicking their son out, their 19-year-old son out on the street. So there's a lot of variables here, but I would be your son does not need to communicate with you. That is one thing that we need to get across here. All that needs to happen is you need to communicate with him. And so if he won't stand still for you to talk to him, that's okay. You can write him a note, and you can tell him, listen, you love him. You think that this is what the issue is, and you think that he's sort of mired in this thing, and that this is the cause of these problems, and you really, really want him to break free, and you know it's difficult, and you're pulling for him. And one of the things you're needing to do is you're needing to essentially change his circumstances to make it so that he has to essentially join the world as it is, rather than getting sucked into a teenage version, a new version of drug addiction, which is the online gaming, you know, virtual world. And we can write that in a handwritten note or a typed out note, and you stick it, stick it right in his hand or stick it right under his door. Okay. And along with it, we say things like, you know, I'm not sure where you're going to go. You don't have to tell me, but I'd be glad to discuss it with you. Whatever it is that you're thinking, I have found out about where the homeless shelter is. And it turns out that I will make sure that the fees that are responsible there, $10 a night or $5 a night or what on earth it is, it may be free, that's a place that you can go, and et cetera. You know, in other words, and you might even come up with a couple other suggestions that seem plausible. He can camp out in his aunt's backyard, possibly, because his aunt volunteered that maybe he could do that. In other words, we might give him a solution or two. I wouldn't overwork it. And then I would be kind, but firm, and concerned. And in other words, we are civil and warm and loving and supportive and firm. Okay? Now, remember that there are two basic manipulative strategies that people use. The number one and actually there's certainly three. Three is just rational discourse and cost-benefit exchanges. But I'm talking about when we use the word manipulative, it has a pejorative slant to it, important to pay attention to. In other words, this is sneaky and somewhat underhanded and disturbing and yanking on parts of human nature in a halfway unfair fashion. Those two strategies are anger and tears. So anger is a threat that says, you are treating me unfairly, and I'm going to impose costs on you until you retract and you make it up to me. So this young man is signaling anger towards his parent, basically saying you're being unfair. Okay? And the parent is not being unfair, and so we are not going to bite on that anger. We're going to be kind and pleasant, but we will recognize that guilt is a natural derivative of somebody leveling anger at us, because guilt is a checking mechanism to make sure that we are, you know, to find out, wait a second, are we being unfair? And if we are being unfair, we need to think this through and then figure out how to make concessions. In this case, the parent is not being unfair, and the parent needs to be concerned and wise and responsible at directing how things are going to go, and then force the hand of the child, because basically the kid's got some kind of quasi-addictive process that's going on here, in all probability. Unless the kid, but we keep the lines of communication open by basically saying, I'm more than happy to talk this out with you and to listen to you and to listen to what's on your mind, okay? And if you want a therapist to talk to, you know, talk to me about that, and we will talk that through. And I'd be happy to talk to this young man over the phone if he wanted to talk to me. Now, so the idea is that we are warm and loving and supportive and intelligent and firm, okay? Now, they will continue to threaten, and then once they figure out that their anger and threaten of withdrawal of the relationship won't work, which is what he's doing right now, sooner or later he may then, you know, at the 11th hour, we may see a bunch of tears. Okay, so tears are actually a method to shift the communication of the relationship away from a threatening, essentially, what is actually an adult-to-adult type of a threat. And instead, it's to shift the meta-communication that's involved to parent-child. So children are by nature more helpless and therefore needing a parental, essentially altruistic behavior in order to protect them. And so when people whine and they cry, what they are doing is that they are unconsciously trying to activate altruistic mechanisms inside the person on the other side of the communication. So this has, of course, happened to me whenever I wanted to raise, and they said no, and then I started to cry. No. The point is that this can happen sort of at any time of life. I actually watched my father, who is just an unbelievable, difficult, tough guy. When suddenly he was in the hospital and in trouble, the guy was sobbing and saying how much he loved his family. It's like, oh, now you love us. Now you love us, but you really need us. Suddenly it's occurring to that Stone Age brain how valuable we all are. That was an amusing and touching moment in my life when that happened to my father. But at any rate, this young man may cascade into tears at some 11th hour or in some period of time. And when that happens, we have to realize that one of the knee-jerk reactions to be on the other side of that is to be very altruistic, because it's yanking a parental circuit. Don't do it. Just keep the communication, nudge it back to adult to adult, and say, yeah, you know, I can understand that this is very difficult and it's hard. I know you're going through things, and I don't want to see you suffer. But let's talk about, you know, what's your plan? And we make that child, who's 19 years old, perfectly intelligent enough to run a computer, we make him essentially force his brain away from a childlike posture that is looking at trying to drag resources out of us, say it's all okay and you can stay another 6 months, and so sorry, okay? That we force that communication back to adult by essentially not looking at him with pity and not looking at him like a broken thing that can't manage this problem, but instead we look at him as a young adult who we're concerned about his choices and we want to help him make better choices, but he's in charge. He's grown up, and we tell him, well, you're grown up, you know what I'm saying, and you and I aren't always going to agree on what was best for you, And but I am behind you, and I'll be as supportive as I can with any decisions that you make. And we keep giving that tone back to where they realize, damn, the tears aren't working. So they aren't consciously trying to do this, but they are vaguely aware that that's what they're trying to do. And when it turns out it doesn't work, they can literally shift, buck up, and start realizing, oh, my God, I'm actually going to have to be self-responsible. Like, that's hard to believe, okay? And so and sometimes what is required is a few nights at the homeless shelter when they find out that you weren't bluffing. And suddenly it becomes important that they better get their act together. So you, once again, they don't have to communicate with you. Relax. You communicate with them. That's good enough. Okay? And we recognize that they are threatening us with the withdrawal of the relationship, with their anger. That's fine. That's just a threat. Don't worry about it. Don't panic about that. Don't panic about their tears, that they're not a four-year-old, that we have to shelter them from every little bump and bruise here. We don't need to do that either. So in general, very kind, warm, loving, supportive, helpful in what it is, the suggestions that we're making, and sensible, okay? But at the end of the day, we are not panicking over their distress. And that is the general strategy for dealing with all situations of this kind.
Fantastic. Well, so...
All right.
She knows what to do now. All right. Everybody, thank you very much for the emails. Dr. Lyle, thank you very much again for the answers, for the questions. And this is great. This is great information. We get to find our edge in life with all this.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.